Darkness, blinding snow, and strong winds likely disoriented the crew of the steamship Princess Sophia as it left Skagway and headed down Lynn Canal. Hours later, the 245-foot ship ran aground on Vanderbilt Reef, north of Juneau. It remained sitting on the reef for a day and a half as over 340 people waited for rescue. But a passing storm intensified, and Vancouver author Ian MacDonald says the 2,300-ton ship was simply pushed right off its perch on the reef.
And they said part of the reef was gleaming like a silver dollar, where when she spun around, the grating of the plates on the rock just gouged the surface, and they could see the mark where she'd spun around. Just the fury of the storm finally took its toll.
Bodies and wrecked lifeboats floated down Lynn Canal for weeks afterwards. Despite the cold water, almost all the victims showed signs of death by suffocation. They were covered in oil. Residents of Juneau volunteered to help clean and process the bodies, despite the threat of the spreading Spanish influenza. The Princess Alice, initially dispatched from Vancouver to help with the rescue, now became a morgue ship. Most of the Princess Sophia's crew lived in Vancouver in Victoria. The White Pass and Yukon Railway Company had over 85 riverboat crew members, captains, and their family members on the Princess Sophia. Juneau's customs collector was on board, and so was as much as 10% of Dawson City's population. Also killed, laborers, business people, and civil servants from all over the Yukon and Alaska. Juneau diver John Lackelt says the sinking left a lot of unfinished business.
Because there was business leaders and folks that were on the ship at the time, there was a lot of things that went unresolved. There was a lot of businesses that didn't get purchased, and there was a lot of development that didn't happen, and there was mines that didn't open, and there were roads that weren't being built, and there was a lot of things that happened that really skewed the course of history.
Captain Leonard Locke continues to be blamed as almost solely responsible for the disaster. Was the ship traveling too fast down Lynn Canal in a blinding snowstorm? Probably. Should Captain Locke have ordered the evacuation of the ship immediately after the grounding, when the first rescue boats arrived? Perhaps. But historian Ken Coates says it's wrong to assume that Captain Locke should have taken the passengers off. They were still relatively safe and comfortable.
The ship seemed to be firmly in place. The passengers themselves were not panicking. The ship's captain was not panicking. They said, "We're stuck here. It doesn't look like there's anything that can move us. We're going to wait till the wind goes down." So, you can imagine under other circumstances, if they were grounded and were tipping over, or grounded and thought they were about to slip off the reef or whatever, they'd react very differently.
James Delgado of the Vancouver Maritime Museum also says it was the worst possible spot to evacuate passengers.
You could have landed some people on the reef, but at what risk? I've been on that reef in flat conditions, and it's a gnarled mass of dragon's teeth covered with sharp barnacles. People in any kind of a sea lowering a boat there stood a risk of having that lifeboat crushed and being thrown into a mass of very sharp rocks that would have cut them up badly if not killed them.
A Canadian inquiry later exonerated Captain Locke and Canadian Pacific Railway Company. But author Ian MacDonald says there was too much deference to a corporation that was considered an institution in the area.
The beauty of it was the age when it was all over, nobody really got blamed. The inquiry, which I think was a bit of a whitewash, decreed that it was the result of perils of the sea. Well, I mean, that wouldn't wash today. They'd be sued rotten. They adduced it was an age when things just happened, and this just happened to be an accident, without really trying to pinpoint the cause.
Despite the enormous loss of life, the Princess Sophia tragedy is largely missing from the collective memories of northern residents. Back in 1918, the Spanish influenza was sweeping across the continent, infecting hundreds of thousands of people in the U.S. and Canada, and claiming as many as 35 million people around the world. Another 10 million were killed in the Great War that was finally ending.
In general terms, there was so much happening, plus the end of this long war, that the Sophia, while in itself was very dramatic, was kind of lost in the shuffle of much bigger historical events.
When the Princess Alice returned to Vancouver with bodies of the Princess Sophia, it was Armistice Day. Residents celebrated. They had no desire to mourn more deaths. Historian Ken Coates also notes the victims of the sinking were from all over Alaska and Western Canada, which was much more integrated and interconnected 80 years ago. But many of the victims were buried elsewhere, not in the communities they originally lived. Freeze-up in the Yukon either delayed or prevented the return of bodies to northern communities like Dawson City.
The final reason, and this applies particularly to the interior, less so to the Juneau area, those regions were so transient that people came and left so quickly that 20 years later, there were very few non-Aboriginal people in the Yukon or even in the interior of Alaska who actually had been affected by the story. They'd left. The teachers had left. The ministers had left. The government officials were no longer there. Many of the leading business people weren't around anymore. And so you have an impermanent society. And it's hard to keep a story alive when you have the people are on the move.
British Columbia resident Ginny Hall was one of those who left her former home in Dawson City. But construction of a memorial there has led to Hall's discovery of her grandmother's sister. Artemise Bell was on the Princess Sophia, along with her son Robert and husband Edward, who worked on a dredge near Dawson. They were buried in Juneau, but little Marie, who turned 1 year old on the day of the wreck, was never found.
It became very personal, and you start to think about the fact that those families were on that boat for those 2 days, waiting to be rescued. It became quite difficult to read those stories. I'd have to stop after a while and go and look at something else. It felt like there was a real connection there.
Today at Vanderbilt Reef, the small inadequate buoy has been replaced by a tall concrete and steel tower with a light, warning away cruise ships, state ferries, and fishing boats. Occasionally, a boat will still head straight for the reef, but now it's with caution and purpose.
Hey folks, if you wait just a moment before you put the flowers in the water, I'll maneuver the vessel so we're right over the wreck.
The ocean current carries out a trail of bright, colorful flowers that stand out against the monochrome gray of the ocean and low clouds. The flowers are a modest and temporary offering. There are no gravestones, no memorials erected here, nothing to remind passersby of those who died and those who remain buried here after the most tragic voyage in Alaska waters. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Matt Miller.